This is Audible.
Audible Originals presents Authentically Mexican, A Family History in Six Dishes. Written and performed by J.P. Bramer. I am a Taco Bueno Mexican. Some of my earliest memories are of my abuelos taking my sister and me to the franchise for tacos, quesadillas, complimentary salsas, and whatever a beef muchacho is. I researched it, and it remains unclear to me. Perhaps the beef muchacho is I. In any case, allow me to walk you through a typical Taco Bueno afternoon. For the uninitiated, if you can imagine a Taco Bell, then you can imagine a Taco Bueno. Taco Bueno is like Taco Bell's slightly younger, tackier sibling with less drive to rule the world because it just won't apply itself. It's not super clear how their shtick is any different, actually, besides the salsa bar that drew abuela to it like a moth to a lamp. If you really want to talk shop, then I'll say Taco Bueno lies somewhere between Taco Mayo and Taco Cabana in terms of aesthetics, with just a hint of Jack in the Box. Yes, Jack in the Box does sell tacos. I would know. Abuela, who is short, brown, and vindictive, is the first to dismount from the little white pickup truck we're routinely crammed into like Hispanic sardines. She steps out into the parking lot and beholds the familiar Taco Bueno through her unimpressed squint, the way she does most things in the world that aren't the goose at the lake she visits once a week, or La Michoacana meat market, and sucks her teeth. Her favorite hobbies are being difficult and watching Rachel Maddow. "That there's a handsome woman, mijo," she often tells me, unprompted. Next comes Chummy, abuelo, or the driver. Abuela calls him Chummy because they're just chums, mijo, that's all. She'll say this with him sitting right next to her. Chummy is kind and patient and keeps his money neatly folded in a Ziploc bag. He drives the pickup truck straight into the parking curb block with an alarming thump, as he always does, and cheerfully announces to the world, "We're here!" He likes mariachi music and dislikes when abuela tells him he's driving wrong, which is anytime he's driving. He whistles music from Fox Animation Studios' Anastasia. "Who wants to watch Anastasia?" he will ask later when we get home. It's the only movie he ever wants to watch. Now come my sister and me, and sometimes a few of our cousins. Where said cousins fit in that pickup, I can't recall. I must have repressed it. On an afternoon like this, my sister and I are probably just out of school for the day. All our classmates just saw us cram into this clown car with mariachi music blaring, and we are very busy processing and compartmentalizing our unpleasant experiences at Catholic school, a favorite activity of ours to this day. We enter Taco Bueno, our haven, our oasis, and set about our routine. Chummy asks us what we want, and we will usually request chicken quesadillas with a side of tortilla chips. But whatever we ask for, it will be a while before we get it, because he always talks the ear off of whoever unfortunate college student happens to be running the register that day. Abuela, meanwhile, raids the salsa bar like a pirate, filling the little white paper cups and wrapping them up in plastic to ferry home. "It's free, mijo," she explains. "That means they can't stop me." Most Mexicans, including Mexican-Americans like me, do well to put distance between themselves and the Tex-Mex chains that are bastardizing the culture, or so many would have you believe. Yes, when the noble enterprise of tortilla making first began around 10,000 BCE in the Sierra Madre, they probably never intended for it to end up in the hands of the Taco Bueno in Lawton, Oklahoma. But the truth is, Mexican-Americans, or Chicanos, or whatever you want to call us, will often exaggerate their disdain for these Tex-Mex chains. "Ugh," we might groan in mixed company. "I bet she's the kind of white girl who thinks Chipotle is real Mexican food." We don't do this for any cool reasons, mind you, like hating capitalism or wanting to support local businesses instead of corporations. It's usually for silly reasons, like impressing gringos or convincing ourselves that we're real Mexicans after all, proven by the fact that we vehemently hate fake Mexican things. And sure, I wouldn't go out of my way to defend the Taco Bueno in my hometown like it's some kind of UNESCO World Heritage Site, although there is a pretty sick mural of an iguana wearing sunglasses in there. No, Taco Bueno, especially the one my abuelos and I frequented, is a shameless commercial spoof of Mexicanismo. It looks like a cartoon hacienda in a cartoon desert, filled with cartoon Mexicans with massive sombreros taking siestas by huge saguaro cacti. The cacti are also cartoons. Why not? But all that being said, I still identify with the Taco Bueno in Lawton, Oklahoma. I identify with its anemic bid at authenticity. I, beef muchacho that I am, identify with its lackluster food, its low, low prices and its overall corniness. Because at the end of the day, I am also a failed attempt at being Mexican. What do I mean by that? Well, where to begin? I'm not much like my abuelos, who were the real deal no matter how much Taco Bueno they chose to eat. They were a matching set, both the same height, both from the same Texas barrio. They were both born into large families with absolutely no money. Abuela was one of 11 children, a fact that harrowed me as I imagined more than one abuela. Abuelo was the first in his entire extended family to go to college, and his mother had been a gruff, cruel woman who'd use chicken eggs and candles to curse people, or so he told me. They were my only reference points to what real Mexicans were in rural Oklahoma, and so, in my head, being a real Mexican had a lot to do with suffering. They had earned their stripes, or rayas, I suppose. I had not. I simply hadn't been raised the way they had. I had been raised by my mom, madre, their daughter, whose childhood, it must be said, was no slice of cakey. That was what my abuela called it, which isn't the Spanish word for cake. Or is it? Over the generations, the Hernandez family trauma printer ran ever lower on ink. My abuelo's parents had suffered greatly, and my abuelo suffered a lot, and my mom some, and me not at all. At least when it came to things like, you know, money and racism. My mom had grown up poor, yes, but there had been occasional treats and holidays and encouragement. More treats than encouragement, though, according to Madre, which was grim considering the occasional treats were things like an ice cream cone from McDonald's. Now, Madre teaches junior high English and is quite popular among her students because she makes fun of them to their faces. She likes French cottage decor, porcelain roosters, and bushel baskets that she fills with potatoes. "Very chateau," she says at Hobby Lobby, purchasing yet another rooster. She is in frequent conflict with Abuela, whom she is always trying to take out to eat somewhere nice. Abuela always replies, "I want La Pizza Hut." Rumbling over where to eat in our little town is a permanent fixture in our lives. It's a major issue for a number of reasons, one being that no one in our family cooks, which means we eat out more than most families. It also provides an arena for Madre and Abuela to hash out their long-standing beefs, which go much deeper than dining options. Madre, who is now middle class, has enough money to take Abuela to nice places. Abuela, who has always been poor, is too proud, too stubborn, and too cognizant of the fact that she's never provided her own daughter with anything too terribly nice. And so she digs in her heels about not wanting or needing Cheddar Bay biscuits from Red Lobster, which is our definition of luxury. My sister and I have front row seats to the antics, which splash over onto us like we're watching Shamu at SeaWorld from the front row. Our job is to pile into the car in the aftermath of the daily "where should we eat" war, shut up, and eat. Usually, this results in a Pyrrhic victory at Golden Corral, a veritable middle American feeding trough. My dad is also there, by the way, being a salesman and being white. Sometimes before a restaurant is chosen, my sister and I retreat into his office as a sort of storm shelter during the melee. So this is us. A family united in not wanting to cook anything ever. We are also a family, as I said before, that is failing at the task of being Mexican. We've lost Spanish because my abuelo struggled with English so much that when they'd finally learned it, they made sure it was all their kids spoke. That's the generous interpretation, anyway. With the other possibility being that they just didn't feel like teaching their children two languages. It's said that my abuela wrestled with English so much that she dropped out of elementary school. I didn't even know you could do that. On top of losing the language, we lost our food. For most cultures out there, food is the great unifier. You might not speak the language, or know the names of the prominent historical figures, or even be able to point to your ancestral country of origin on a map. But your tongue never forgets the taste of Indian tandoori chicken, or Georgian khachapuri, or, I don't know, a Los Angeles Trader Joe's soy chorizo. Food is embedded with deep meaning. A certain spice can taste like home, a meat like a specific neighborhood. A short list of ingredients can, for better or for worse, come to be associated with a people. That's true for everything from your abuela's mole recipe that she cooks out of a bruja in a thatch hut, down to the sea salt fries at Wendy's. If food tells a story, here is the one my family has to share with you. We have given up. We have given up on Spanish, given up on quinceañeras, given up on all the things that would identify us as anything other than regular old Americans sitting in a fast food restaurant. Except we're not regular, because the giving up, The loss itself is palpable, everywhere, in everything. There is the idea that we're supposed to be doing things differently, that something at once foreign and familiar ought to be present. This was made especially clear anytime someone died. People did die every so often, as my extended family was huge, especially abuelas. And like her, they were all really old. Someone would die, and we would cram ourselves into the truck to head down to Texas for a funeral. It was after these funerals that I would get a glimpse into my family's culinary traditions. There were enchiladas, huevos rancheros, chiles rellenos, and pan dulce in fantastic, sugary pastels. Not every branch of the family shared my abuelo's vision of assimilation. Some still held on to home, carried it on their backs no matter how far they went. It made them heavier and made the act of moving around in America much more cumbersome. But I found myself romanticizing it. Sitting in the annex of Nuestra Señora de Guadalupe Church, in the barrio where my abuelos had grown up, I would find myself yearning for a tradition that I could taste. I imagined my relatives, the ones sitting around me whose names I didn't know, sweating over steaming tamales at Christmas time, chopping up vegetables for pozole, the moms calling out from the kitchen, telling their rambunctious kids that it was dinner time and they better wash their hands and come sit down. This desire, homesickness for a home I had never had, stuck with me over the years. It's what eventually led me to get into cooking. After college, where my diet consisted mainly of ramen and prepackaged Walmart sandwiches, I decided I wanted to figure out how to make Mexican food. The learning curve would be steep, I knew that. But this was something of a holy quest, and so I resolved to climb the hill. I didn't know a thing about navigating a kitchen at age 22. There were so many different kinds of knives, so many different ways to prepare something, and so many pots and pans and gadgets with unknown purposes. It's all just a series of steps, I told myself each time I approached a new recipe. But I aimed too high. The first recipes I wanted to make all involved too much slicing and waiting and watching. I decided to start again at square one. Prepare an egg. From there, I graduated. I learned how to make arroz con pollo, which, true to its name, is just a matter of rice and chicken. I made it about a dozen times before moving on. And over time, I learned how to cook more complicated dishes. Now I can make a mean enchilada suiza and even chilaquiles. I became obsessed with making food. I watched countless YouTube videos about chopping techniques and stewing and using a comal. I got so into food that I started writing about it, publishing pieces in Food and Wine and getting a free meal or two at some swanky New York establishments in exchange for a possible review. I never actually reviewed them, as reviewing was not my wheelhouse. Sorry, Racines. But still, it felt glamorous. As I thought back to afternoons at Taco Bueno, these new dining experiences also showed me that the food world is one of deep chasms of class, even if the ingredients more or less stay the same. The difference between a $2 taco and a $10 one often came down to presentation, and I became obsessed with observing these differences. I was attracted to the idea that ingredients could start out in one place and, through human interference and general nonsense, end up in two very different echelons. I was obsessed with the process, I think, because I saw myself in it. I felt I was immersing myself in a food culture, a Mexican food culture, which was both familiar and alien. I recognized all the ingredients, but they were articulated so differently from how I'd known them growing up. It was during this food writing kick that I began to reflect on my own culinary history. I called up my mom one muggy summer day in Brooklyn to ask her if there were any recipes in our family I'd overlooked, something I could write about. "You might want to ration those stories," she said, recognizing the fact that we didn't have many family recipes floating around. But I thought harder, and I realized that I did have a culinary tradition, just like all living things that eat do. My family did have recipes, even if only a handful. Those recipes together tell a story, my family story. They may tell it better than any photo album or home video ever could. 1. Tortillas. There are no memories in my life more vivid than those involving tortillas. I was raised on tortillas, eggs, and bacon. I often woke up to the smell of tortillas being made in the kitchen downstairs, days when abuelo and abuela had spent the night with us. This happened a lot during the winter, because their house didn't have a heater and it was too cold. Sometimes it happened in the summer, too, for the opposite reason. My mom told me Abuela used to make all kinds of food. She'd make enchiladas, cakes, and tamales. I could picture this. Her eyes would be fixed in a capable squint. There'd be a rickety fan going in the kitchen, and she'd be talking while chopping and rolling and separating this from that. This was how she made tortillas, one of the few recipes that survived the ravages of Abuela's unwillingness to save anything. At some undefined point, Abuela had decided to simply stop preparing food. The way my mom tells it, she decided to stop doing things in general. Long before I was born, Abuela had briefly taken a job at a high school cafeteria, but then quit because, quote, they were telling me what to do. She stopped driving, she stopped cleaning, she stopped cooking. She put her foot down, and to the demands of regular life, she said, no. What caused this shift is a mystery to me and my parents. Her tortillas were one of the only ways to see the skill she'd once so casually wielded. She'd churn them out like they were nothing, like she was barely thinking about it. This is the kind of capability one develops out of grueling repetition and necessity. I could practically hear her mom yelling in Abuela's childhood home, Annie, go and make some tortillas. I could smell that house, too. Or at least I thought I could. The smell of flour and lard, the faintest aluminum hint of baking powder. It was the smell of a busy house in constant commotion with busy women at the center of it all, scraps and bits and pieces being prepped and presented, the steady flux of traffic through the beating heart of the kitchen, a living thing. This was the bright picture that came to mind on those mornings when I could smell the tortillas from upstairs in my room, when I would hear Abuela scolding Abuelo, Chami, hand that to me. It should be established here and now that these were no regular tortillas. These tortillas were nothing short of miraculous, and everyone who tried them agreed. My sister and I would gift them, still piping hot, steam clouding the Ziploc bag, to our teachers every year to curry favor. Oh, hell yes, my fourth grade teacher, a nun, once said while accepting them. Such was their power. No secret ingredient could account for this. The tortillas were made of regular tortilla stuff, harina, salt, baking powder, lard, and hot water. In the correct measurements, these will make tortilla dough, sure enough. But it wasn't about measurements for me. Cups, teaspoons, etc. That diminishes art into science. It was the unthinking competence, the way it seemed like Abuela didn't have to try at all, that enchanted me. I was tired of trying so, so hard at everything I had to do. You see, at some point in my young life, I pieced the puzzle together and figured out that I was Mexican. Yes, there were hints growing up, like the time my family and I were packed in a van and driving through a rich neighborhood in Dallas to look at the elaborate Christmas light displays, and my aunt said, see this? We make this shit happen. It's all Mexicans. There was also the fact that, well, half of my family was brown, like dark brown. When Abuela walked me to school on my first day of sixth grade, people asked me, was that your nanny? Are you a rich boy? Thanks to my dad, I'm somewhat pale. It took me a full 2 weeks to ride out that storm, the rich boy taunt dying down, only to be replaced with the less confusing commentary on my weight. I started to feel uncomfortable in my own skin, in my own culture. I felt like I was a fraud. I wanted to be the real deal. This was a pivotal moment for me, because growing up I hadn't wanted to be Mexican at all. We would go to Mexican restaurants on occasion, which I actually hated as a kid. I hated all the onions and refried beans. I hated the gaudy decor, the sombreros and piñatas and putting everything on pause to sing Feliz Cumpleaños. I felt like I was an unwilling part of something deeply tacky, a culture that must have had a better story to tell than cheap and cheesy. But in middle school, there I was, changing my mind and thinking, I'll gladly wear the sombrero if it means putting this identity crisis to bed. Feliz Cumpleaños to me. What you want to know that for? Abuela once told me after I'd asked her to teach me to make her tortillas. She had her tools, her ceramic bowl with little blue birds painted on it. She had her wooden roller and board that we used to joke was the foot of the true cross that Jesus had been nailed to because it was so old and had produced so many miracles. I want to learn, I told her. But she'd always, always respond with, I'll make you some. This, I was pretty sure, was an intentional diversion on Abuela's part. There was some piece of her that liked to be relied upon for this one thing, even if she'd abdicated the rest of her responsibilities. My Mexican family mostly hails from Chihuahua in northern Mexico. This makes perfect sense with the tortillas, because flour tortillas are largely a norteño borderland affair. The farther south you go, the less likely you are to encounter flour tortillas. Corn tortillas rule over the majority of Mexico, and their history stretches back much farther. We're talking 10,000 years before Christ. The legend states that a Mayan peasant made the first corn tortilla for his hungry king. For centuries, they were made by soaking maize in lime, then forming corn dough and heating it on a comal, a smooth, flat griddle. Tortillas de harina, flour tortillas, arrived much later. Wheat flour, after all, wasn't even introduced to the Americas until the Spanish arrived in the 1500s. Needless to say, the whole Spanish arriving thing adds plenty of controversy to the story of the tortilla. They were not ideal guests. Flour tortillas were born of the ensuing colonial conflict that remains to this day. Many things in Mexico have this in common with the flour tortilla. They were intimately shaped by a violent collision, the shrapnel of a founding explosion. Catholicism and the Spanish language met and aggressively attempted to supplant indigenous cultures and beliefs. This, of course, was not entirely possible. Many of these indigenous cultures still exist and hold on to their customs. An even larger number of people of Mexican descent navigate a world shaped by syncretism, a mixture of European and indigenous influences. Mexican Catholicism is a good example. We have the saints and Jesus and all, but we also have Dia de Muertos and a cult-like worship of Our Lady of Guadalupe, Mother Mary, who stands in the place of female pre-Columbian deities. So it goes with the tortilla, a word the Spanish gave us. Tortilla comes from the word torta, or cake, so it literally means little cake. If you order a tortilla in Spain, you're getting a potato omelet thing. But in northern Mexico and the southwest USA, where wheat is easier to grow, you're getting a flour tortilla in burrito, enchilada, or taco form. This is the legacy that ended up in our little Ziploc bags on those early mornings in Oklahoma, when the sun wasn't out yet, and Abuela would wake us with her humming as she rolled the dough and tossed it like a frisbee onto the comal. She'd use her bare hands to flip them, and she wouldn't teach me. She never outright refused or said no. She'd just make them before I had a chance to ask, or pretend I'd ask for something else. I had to soldier on without her. It sounded easy enough. One can simply Google flour tortilla recipe, for example, and end up with a serviceable product. But that's not what I was after. I wanted authenticity. I wanted to flip a tortilla over an open flame with my bare hand. I wanted to roll the dough around without even looking at it. I wanted the effortlessness that tradition gives you, the way you know how to do something because you had to, because your mother called for you to come do it again and again and again. This is culture. But I didn't have that, so I would have to look for the next best thing, YouTube tutorials and white women's food blogs. I located one called Country Life, City Wife, with a tortilla recipe that seemed close enough to my abuela's. Lightning, please don't strike me, but I'll eat them with hot dogs and cheese whiz, the city wife wrote on her list of suggestions. I owe her my life. I lean heavily on her recipe to this day. I pieced together abuela's tortillas in this manner. I made them once while she was still alive, and her reaction was, "Oh, nice." In retrospect, I wonder if she wasn't really holding her recipe tight to her chest. It's entirely possible she simply didn't care about it that much. Abuela's neglect was a strong, sturdy thing that never budged. Once she decided on apathy, that was it. Her passion was spent elsewhere, like on playing slots and plotting to find and strangle George W. Bush. With or without her, I had reinvented her tortillas for myself. This was an impulse that lived strongly in me. The desire to have. I wanted Spanish, wanted recipes, things that my brain conceived of as tangible objects, coveted treasures. I wanted to manifest what was so frustratingly intangible, to hold in my hands what was constantly slipping through my metaphorical fingers. It's an impulse I held all the way up to Abuela's death. I asked Madre for certain things Abuela had owned, her Mother Cabrini necklace, some of the elaborate doilies she had stitched, but one thing had actually been bequeathed to me. It was her old tortilla set, the splintery wooden block and roller. I held it like some hold their college diploma. I vowed to cherish these rickety, failing objects and to place them at the very center of my identity. Like most things related to my melodramatic, capital I identity saga, Madre saw it and thought, eh. I know this because the night before Abuela's funeral, she put the set in the dishwasher to clean it. This, to be clear, is something one should never do with solid wood. But Madre had inherited Abuela's penchant for approaching everyday domestic tasks from bizarre directions. The morning of her funeral, in my black shoes and blazer, I found Abuela's tortilla set, now mine, warped from the water and heat. Just like that, a whole legacy had collapsed. And it was my fault. Although Madre was a guilty accomplice. Why would it be my fault? Well, I figured that this was the inevitable outcome of putting such an important heirloom in my incapable hands. Our cultural history had rejected me, had splintered and distorted, because I was a pretender. I wasn't the real deal. I was convinced this would be the case with anything I tried to hold. My Spanish would always suck, my food would never taste quite as good, and I would always, always, be just a little bit of a knockoff. I could aspire to be Mexican my whole life, but I would never achieve symmetry between my desire and my experience. There weren't enough authentically Mexican objects in the world that would make me the real thing. If I got them, I'd probably just ruin them. I was on the verge of tears, tears that came easier to me in that moment than they had when I'd first learned of Abuela's death. Why? Was what was going through my head. Why? In tandem with the frantic beating of my heart. I reverted to childlike pleas, presenting the set to my dad, pleading, fix it. I chastised my mother. I asked Our Lady of Guadalupe above, was there a reason for this? Really? Seriously? Did you have to? Shamefully, I found my thoughts drifting to the tortilla set during Abuela's funeral, where I sat in a creaky pew and a mariachi band performed her favorite hymn, I Will Go, Lord, If You Lead Me, in Spanish. I thought of that damn tortilla set being bent back into shape in the garage by my dad's carpenter clamps. I think so much like an American at the end of the day. Whether or not I realize it, my intentions often wander into accumulation, into having and owning and possessing. I want. And I respond to the desire by trying to feed it, sate it, by taking as much as the world will let me take. But where my American brain centers on gaining, my Mexican brain centers on losing, focusing, in a borderline obsessive manner, on things that have been taken away and can't be retrieved. These two minds desperately collided when I saw Abuela's tortilla set on that afternoon in Texas. After the service, I went home, only to find that, by some miracle, the tortilla set had been restored. The clamps, which I'd had so little faith in, had actually done their job. It was flat again, for all the use it still had in it. It had, after all, been splintery and old well before the dishwasher had ever gotten a hold of it. I'd have been better off using something else, something new. When my family had gone to sleep, I walked into the kitchen alone. Look at you, I told it aloud. You're just a hunk of wood. 2. Caldo de pollo. I was sick a lot as a child, and this was because I chose to be. What I mean by that is I hated going to school, so I would elect to be so sick that I simply couldn't attend. Some would probably call this a sickness unto itself. To them I would have said, call it whatever you want, as long as I don't have to see Sister Tia Linda or my wretched classmates until next Monday. As a Mexican-ish, I was raised Catholic. And as a Catholic with money-ish, I went to Catholic school. There was only one in Lawton, St. Mary's, with its bell tower, its rose window, and all the ritual pageantry one expects out of Catholicism. Priests in robes, nuns in their solemn habits, crucifixes everywhere. The ornate decor was jarring compared to the drab surroundings of Lawton. But Catholicism's melodrama will not be encumbered, not even by the flatness of the Great Plains. I wasn't a good student, and I was an even worse Catholic. I just couldn't wrap my head around the narrative. Everything was mysteries and miracles and people being tortured to death for following God's orders. The nuns seemed to relish these stories of cruelty. They liked to tell us suffering was important, that it brought us closer to God. They'd smack us on the hand with a ruler for minor infractions. If suffering made you a good person, then I ought to have been canonized. I hated, hated, hated St. Mary's. I hated getting up at 5 a.m. on Wednesdays to go to early morning mass. I hated the navy tie around my neck, which always felt like it was gently strangling me. Most of all, I hated my classmates, who made frequent remarks about my looks. They even mocked my personality, which, at the tender age of 9, closely reflected that of a sour old man sitting on his porch telling stories absolutely no one wanted to hear. "Hello, fatty," I would be greeted. "How creative." I was quite overweight on account of all the aforementioned Taco Bueno, Pizza Hut, and tortillas with eggs and bacon. Not even the constant threat of a righteous God can keep children from being cruel. All this meant St. Mary's was the last place on earth I wanted to be, but also, I had to be there. I had no choice, no alternative, except for one. I found refuge in sickness, or in feigning sickness. I had one favorite spot in the otherwise dreary halls of St. Mary's, and that was the nurse's office, where I became a regular. I would raise my hand, ask to go to the bathroom, and force myself to vomit. I was not one of those people who used oatmeal or whatever, and if I had, perhaps there would be a recipe in here for fake puke. No, I was, and continue to be, an all-or-nothing kind of hombre. So I would gag and dry heave until I actually vomited. I would then, for whatever reason, flush the vomit down the toilet and inform Sister Teolinda, my fourth grade teacher and a silver-haired parody of a schoolmarm, that I was terribly ill. With a roll of her eyes, she would send me to the nurse, my safe space. I would lie on a treatment table that was wrapped in squeaky plastic and wait for the nurse to tell me there was nothing wrong with me. I would turn my face and stare at a laminated copy of the Lord's Prayer, cursive text accompanied by a lamb walking into a pastel sunset. "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done." But in fact, it was my will being done, because most of the time I got what I wanted. I was sent home. My mom would have to drop whatever she was doing at her teaching job at the junior high a few blocks away and pick me up, usually muttering something like, "What am I going to do with you, huh?" as we marched out the doors. Back in her classroom, she'd plop me down on a chair next to her desk, where her female students would tell me I was cute because I was plump and quiet. Then the bell would ring, and we'd go home, my mom clearly frustrated with her problem child, and for good reason. I was always pulling her away from work, never doing what I was supposed to do. And then, on top of everything else, with the ungrateful gall children possess, I'd cry. I'd cry buckets of tears. Cry at nothing, really, but also at everything. At my own ineptitude, at having to go to an expensive Catholic school, at being fat, at the mere reality of being me. My parents tried in vain to find the source of my fake illness. I even had an x-ray done. This culminated in a visit to a doctor's office where I had to drink some sort of heinous nightmare medical milkshake that dyed my insides and I had to wear a heavy lead blanket so my guts could be observed. Once again, I was told, "There's nothing wrong with you." I continued to fake being sick until one day, the real thing hit me like a ton of bricks. I was in a Hastings, which was like a blockbuster injected with too much anime or, for the literal children out there, like if Netflix were a physical store with DVDs and Twizzlers. I was standing in front of a magazine rack, staring, as I often did, at the country home decor section, when I suddenly realized my body was on fire. My blood was lava, and my head felt like there was a rabid weasel in it trying to gnaw itself free from my skull. I collapsed in such a dramatic fashion that even the version of me that faked these sort of things would have thought it was a bit hammy. "No," I moaned. My mom craned over me. "This again?" she asked, exasperated. "John Paul, I'm getting tired of this. You're not sick." "No, I'm sick," I groaned. She grabbed my hand and tried to yank me up by the arm, but my body was a bag of hot coals. I started to cry, a different flavor of tears than the ones I was used to, these being involuntary without any dimension of wallowing or self-pity. It was a raw, animal cry. "Oh, God," my mom said. "Are you okay?" I got home, hit the bed, and didn't move for what felt like 2 sweaty, achy days. Diagnoses would crest and submerge like strange fish breaking the surface. The flu? Strep? An ancient familial curse? We couldn't figure out what was wrong. All we knew was that, for once, I was actually sick. It was as if the sickness were getting back at me for all the times I'd faked it. It must have been the third day of my illness when my mom went back to work, sure enough that I would probably survive, and my care was put in the hands of Abuela. Now, this might sound like a terrible idea, given all I've told you about her so far. Abuela was gruff, stubborn, and not exactly the most nurturing person alive. But that's not who she was whenever I got sick. When I was sick, actually sick, Abuela transformed into an entirely different person. She would sit down on the couch, put a pillow on her lap, and lay my head on it. She would put a cold washcloth to my forehead and bob her knees gently, politely asking the roaring sickness to calm down. Shh, shh. It was a far cry from the woman who would leave me in the casino parking lot to go play slots. But most peculiar of all, she'd cook. This was different from when she'd make tortillas, an activity I did not think of as cooking. It was more like breathing or getting dressed in the morning, just something she did on autopilot. This cooking involved an actual pot filled with actual ingredients, like chicken and vegetables and seasonings, which, if you knew Abuela, might have shocked the disease out of you all on its own. Caldo de pollo translates to chicken soup, but as someone who's had both, I can tell you it's a lot more than that. For one thing, caldo de pollo accepts chicken parts that its Campbell's cousin would not. If you can cut it off a chicken's body, it can go into caldo de pollo, and it goes in whole. Our version also tends to be spicier, but that's more or less a given. One thing it has in common with chicken soup, however, is its association with healing properties. The ancient Mexicans didn't distinguish between food and medicine. Years and years after Abuela last made me caldo de pollo, I talked to a curandera, a traditional Mexican healer, about the recipe's relationship to sickness and health. It was during my food writing days in New York, and I was hoping she could tell me what ingredients might have gone into my abuela's recipe, ingredients that had been lost to time and never written down. Over the phone, the curandera told me about the cosmic kitchen, the inherited belief that there was a guiding energy to life, a belief that led the Aztecs, for example, to stir their cooking pots in a certain direction just to act in harmony with that energy. She also told me I might never know exactly what went into abuela's caldo de pollo, and I was disheartened. But the most important ingredient was the energy, she reassured me. I do believe that as Mexicans, we are most ourselves when a family member is sick. We have all of these rituals and practices reserved just for illness. Sprite for the belly, sana sana colita de rana, an unshakable belief that vapor rub could cure cancer if we would just let it. On the day I thought I might die from whatever demonic illness that struck me down in Hastings, Abuela got to work. She set me up on the couch and put a washcloth on my head. She headed to the kitchen and got to chopping. Carrots, potatoes, celery, and peppers. Chunks of chicken went into the pot along with their bones. And corn tortillas, store-bought, as Abuela never made corn tortillas and they seemed to be reserved for just these occasions, adorned the sides of the serving bowl. When I think of the healing process, be it physical or emotional, I think of dipping a piece of corn tortilla into broth, the surface slick with oily fat, and the heat chasing the sick from my fingers. I survived that particular bout of whatever it was, but I hardly remember the sickness itself. I remember more vividly Abuela putting her usual self aside and setting about the ritual act of making me better. It's common for Chicanos to experience what I think of as memory without memory. Our childhoods are littered with rites and practices that seem at once familiar and entirely alien. Abuela's caldo de pollo, the smell of herbs, the kinder, softer spirit that would briefly animate her until I was well again. These took on the quality of ancient things, things that had survived for hundreds of years and would survive for hundreds more, things that had made up their minds to endure. It would be years later, when I was living in New York and working as a writer, that Abuelita herself would become sick. This wasn't a common thing for her, besides the passing sniffle, for which she always had a trusty hanky. I say she became sick because it was the kind of sickness that nestles into one's identity, the kind that rearranges the very pillars of your being and makes you into someone else. Dementia is what the doctors called it, but I thought of it more as, what if Abuelita, but too much? Her old personality was there, but amped up to a degree that made her all but impossible to deal with. She became obsessed with finding out which of her grandchildren were white, even the ones who had the same parents and would technically be the same degree of white and not white. She would tell me there was a jaguar in the creek behind our house. You watch out for that cat, mijo. She interrogated her family. Sandy, she said to my mother. What kind of name is Sandy, huh? Well, my mother, Sandy, said, you're the one who picked it. You tell me. I didn't understand how dementia could tilt one toward death, what the mechanics of a dementia-related death were. But that's what it did, and for Abuela, it took on the form of not eating. She refused food. She refused everything, really. She simply said her favorite word, no. Only a more intense no than ever before, until the world whittled her away and she was gone. It was October, and I returned to Texas with my family for her funeral, held in a small church in the barrio, thinking of the warped tortilla set waiting back home. We went through all the Catholic rites, the prayers and hymns and burial. Madre had gone about arranging the whole thing herself, their mother-daughter dynamic strong to the very end. We spent some time reminiscing, talking about how crazy Abuela had been. Not even death will spare one from being roasted in our family. But in the end, we still felt incomplete, like there was something we hadn't done. That year, for the first time, we agreed to celebrate Dia de Muertos. I can't say we were reclaiming it because it had never been celebrated in our house before. My abuelos did hold a belief in a vague, general mysticism. Abuela thought she had experienced a few miracles, like a flower blooming right in front of her, which I find poignant. She also thought Pope John Paul II had appeared and spoken to her. This ended up being a souvenir Madre had bought her from the Vatican, a coffee mug that showed a picture of the Pope when exposed to hot water. Miracles are subjective, I suppose. They did believe in what I could loosely refer to as magic, in the form of using eggs to absorb sin, or the idea that a hot brick placed under the bed could heal someone. But these beliefs never quite came together to form what I would call faith. They were more like tchotchkes on a shelf, individual curiosities. Dia de Muertos, in my mind, was much more formal, a clear, confident articulation of a worldview, an afterlife. In the wake of Abuela's death, my family experienced some ancestral gravity pulling us into this form of mourning, even without a formal belief system to back it up. Or perhaps we, like many gringos, were simply drawn to the golden flowers and candles and smiling sugar skulls, dazzled by the aesthetics. It would be nice if it were the former, but either way, the destination was the same. Mixquic, a village just outside of Mexico City, our faces painted by some little girls who'd beckoned us through the open front doors of their house. Dia de Muertos, like Caldo de Pollo, like so much else in Mexican culture, is based on old, old, old things, modified for the present. Sugar skulls, altars, and marigolds commingle with Catholic saints, Guadalupe, and prayers. Here, too, a crucial component is food. Fresh plates of chicken and mole, steaming hot bread, and mugs of champurrado are placed on the ofrendas, or altars for the dead, so that the souls of loved ones